You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Grant Newsham's going to join me. He's Virginia. There's a couple of components to Virginia. They like to discuss the hybrid nature of their culture from the Tidewater. With a short little note, said I had a good time. But there's another side to it. Ponytails, right? T-shirts. Didn't sign her name, I wonder. Handguns. That's a little... So joining me from Taipei is Grant Newsham. Grant, how you doing?
Fine, thanks.
You look.
Here's my double wide trailer.
All you have to do is slap on a "Virginia is for lovers" sticker, and they'll say, "Oh, we get it now." So yeah, it's in your DNA. We know that. The are you excited? The Senators, the Nationals, and the Yankees will start the some version of the Major League Baseball opening day. In about a month, or less than a month. Are you excited about that?
Oh, well, that's interesting. I think to have some actually normal human activity in general is a nice change. Where's it going to be?
I believe in the nation's capital.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Is Eddie Brinkman starting at shortstop?
Eddie Brinkman, for those of you who don't know this, Eddie Brinkman, former shortstop, for the Washington Senators, had one of the biggest heads of any human beings I've ever seen in my life.
He was it was sort of rectangular.
He had a robust head.
But did you know that when he was in, I think it was high school, that he was like, he played in the same league or such with Pete Rose. And Brinkman was considered the better prospect, I have read, so.
Well, Rose certainly throughout his life consistently proven he's the greater criminal, though.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
That's true. My dad was in Major League Baseball, and he, the Cincinnati Reds fired Sparky Anderson in the midst of the Big Red Machine, or kind of towards the end of it, actually. And then he went to Detroit and he won again. Anyway, my dad got hired to replace him. And Pete Rose had played out his option that year. And so I remember talking to my dad, and I said, "Hey, are the Reds going to re-sign Pete Rose? I mean, you're going to manage Pete Rose." And he said, "Yeah, I don't think they want to." And I said, "What?" He said, "Mike, like, this is not for publication, but Pete Rose is not a very high-quality human being." I said,
"Oh my goodness."
I said, "What do you mean? I mean, because, you know, back then, nobody knew stuff like that. You know, he was Charlie Hustle. He was like the little engine that could, you know, a guy with no talent that made it to the big leagues." And my dad looked at me and goes, "All of that is lies, okay? He's got a ton of talent, and he gets the most out of it, but he's just not a good human. He's got gambling debts all over the country. Organized crime people are looking for him. It's just not a good story." I was like, "Whoa, Pete Rose, who knew? Who knew?" And then, lo and behold, then it all got to play out in public. So, yeah. So baseball, yeah, you know what? Anything, a relief from the news, please.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to, say, sports getting started.
Let me ask you this. What is, so you're in a foreign, American in a foreign land. What is Taiwan's view of what's going on in the United States right now?
Oh, I don't think it. I think people have other things to worry about.
So they don't care?
Quite honest, not so much. It'd be, you know, kind of in, you know, like the way, say, a foreigner might think of Detroit. You know, they know in America that there's Detroit. A place that, like Detroit, people from Detroit don't get angry. But, you know, so they know American big cities are kind of strange places, and now I think they think the entire country is like a big American city. So it's kind of not quite the shock that one might think, but they, as I say, I think the people have just had so much to think about on their own lives that have gotten disrupted that I'm not so sure it's, like, the first thing people think about when they get out of bed.
What yeah, is, well, I wasn't asking you if it was like they had top of the mind awareness, but if as they approach you, do they, is there a trend? Do they, you know, are they intrigued, amused? Do they give a shit? Is there something they ask you on a regular basis about events unfolding very dramatically here in the United States?
Not really.
They don't give a shit.
Maybe people are too polite to ask about it, but it is surprising just how seldom anybody, you know, mentions the nuttiness that's going on.
Got it.
You know, and some of the stuff that I would, you know, the, what do you call it? You know, everybody wears masks and that sort of thing, and you know that we would have thought was a big deal, but that's all kind of normal this time of year, or not so much this time of year. But it's for some reason it doesn't. You know, it's like everybody's got their own problems, and I don't seem to answer questions about that nearly as much. You know, to include like what's going to happen in November.
Oh,
I think about it. I don't. You know, nobody asks about it much.
This morning in Taiwan? What is what's the number one story? And have they still largely been spared of the coronavirus? Still, I mean, I've read stories. I haven't read anything recently about it. So what is the top story in the news in Taiwan today? And B, give us a COVID-19 update from the island, Grant Newsham.
From the island. They still don't have very many sick people. The cases are extremely low. Everyone, like, probably the rest of Asia, everybody goes around looking like the masked bandits, but that's part of the game. But I would say it's, you know, Chinese airplanes, you know, flying towards this place, you know, more often than they've ever done. The verbal threats, those things from the Chinese, those get a lot of attention. So the sort of the defense sort of topic is one that is foremost. It's surprising just how understood it is at a lot of different levels of society and how aware they are of it. And then there's the usual is the economy, you know, which is, you know, is it going to hold up, you know, under the virus thing? But it's in some ways, it's sort of the same old stuff that people have been worried about before the problem, the disease started. But it, you know, and when is the quarantine going to end so people, whether the borders can open up more. But it's not, you know, in some ways it's different, other ways it's not.
Got it. What about the story in I don't know which American defense publication it is, on a Senate Armed Service, a bit of an amendment the markup of the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act, talking about the inclusion of Taiwan in RIMPAC. Tell me about that. I mean, that's Taiwan attempting to bust China's attempt to contain them, and that would be no small feat for them to begin to participate in RIMPAC.
It would. That's something that, you know, it really people who think about those things notice. You know, it's not.
Oh.
You know, like everybody's, you know, overjoyed. Everybody's thinking about it, but at the level of, you know, say people who are responsible and think about national defense, that is a potentially a big deal, but at this point, you know, I think the Taiwanese are sort of waiting to be, let's see the goods.
Lucy with the football again?
Yeah, this has been raised before, and you know, it's been so bad that, you know, in past RIMPAC, you know, there's a Taiwan office in Hawaii, and in past RIMPACs, they haven't even been allowed to, like in civilian clothes, go look at anything. And it's happening like a mile from where they are. And that's how, I say, what do you call it, unneighborly our treatment of them has been.
Yes.
The, you know, been thoroughly intimidated by the Chinese to the point that the official Taiwan representatives in the United States are not even allowed to just even watch from a distance something that's going on at RIMPAC. So they're, I think, justifiably
skeptical.
You know, yeah, but that's, but who knows? You know, this administration has done more than all the others put together. So if they were to invite Taiwan to RIMPAC, and you never know, that maybe they're going to surprise us, and that would be a big thing. The Chinese are, of course, outraged by this, but it's our party. We're the United States of America, and we decide who we want to invite. But it would be a nice thing. But it, you know, ideally, it would be something that is done into the future, not just a one-off sort of event. And we'll see how it goes. But that would be something big.
All right. You wrote a piece that you sent to me and said this will get me on other lists that say do not invite, about Japan's decision to end its dance with the land-based Aegis missile defense system. First of all, can you explain the initiative first, and then explain Japan's decision, and then interject yourself why it doesn't add up?
Oh, yes. What I did is I wrote a story about the Japanese government just last week or so, or the week before, canceling a project they had signed with the Americans, with an American company, Lockheed, to build two what are called Aegis Ashore missile defense systems. And those are like the Aegis missile defense systems that are on Navy ships, but they're on shore and they're at fixed sites. And a few years ago, Japan ordered a couple of these, and the idea was to give them some protection, specifically from North Korean missiles, but theoretically from anybody else who might send a missile towards Japan. And the project was underway, and the hardware being developed and tested. And there was some difficulty finding a location where to put this, because they thought they had approval for the sites. And then it turned out the locals started complaining about this and that, arguing it was more dangerous than the government had let on, et cetera, et cetera. It was really not, it was what the locals always do in Japan when you try to do something which that's necessary to defend Japan.
Well, specifically in the article that I read, it said that the government couldn't guarantee that the missile, the rocket, the portion of the missile that contained the rocket and not the warhead would not land in civilian locations. It could not. They want it to be like SpaceX, right? After the thing explodes, then it like guides itself down to some offshore platform. And so the locals were up in arms about that. That's at least the story that I read.
Well, that's one of the excuses. But anyway, the deal was good. The project was going, and it was going. And then suddenly, it's almost out of the blue, the Japanese government announced they were going to suspend it. And then a few days later, they announced it was dead in the water. They weren't going to go ahead with it. And so you canceled a deal in midstream that was part of this sort of joint U.S.-Japan effort to defend the country from enemy missiles. And it surprised a lot of people. And what I wrote about is, my point was that when you look at the excuses, that it doesn't quite add up. In fact, if you kind of have heard all the excuses before, that you kind of you got to laugh or smirk, as I put in the article. And because what they've said is, the government has said, is that, well, it costs too much. And it's expensive, make no mistake. It was about $4 billion for the two systems, which is a lot of money to some people, but not to the Japanese government when it's throwing money around. That's like the amount of fraud in an unnecessary highway they build sometime. I'm sort of joking, but it's just not much money for a government, for an economy this big. And then they said, and then the locals were complaining. Well, the locals complain about everything in Japan when you want to do something defense related. And it's always kind of, some of it's serious, but also some of it is there's a shakedown aspect to it. But so the point is, the locals all always complain. And so what I said was, well, you know, if you that's your standard, is it cost too much and the locals complain, well, why doesn't Abe, the prime minister, call up Okinawa and tell them to cancel the runway construction project where they're building a runway at Camp Hansen, Camp Schwab,
right,
in order to replace Futenma, because that's like many, many times more expensive. And the locals have complained about it. So and at least each issue, you can say that it has some military usefulness.
Right.
People might argue this, but the base of the replacement runway at Camp Schwab does not have any military usefulness beyond the most minimal, and it has less than Futenma. So if that's not a very good excuse, you know, to my way of thinking. So you ask, well, what's the real reason here? And I think what really is going on is it's some domestic politics at work. It's not really anything. It's not a considered move by the government on really any grounds other than I think something screwy is going on associated with the deal itself. So I just point this out about the Aegis system, but my larger point is that when it comes to Japan's defense, that historically there has never been the Japanese government has never taken a systematic approach to what Japan needs to defend itself. And it buys these very, really shiny objects or silver bullet weapons. They'll buy these expensive, sort of cool sounding systems. And the idea is if you buy a couple of them, it'll scare the enemy off and your defense problems are solved. They've done this, like with F-35s, so that was going to fix everything. With these two sort of jury-rigged aircraft carriers, that was going to get a couple of those, and Chinese are going to roll over. Global Hawk as well. They buy these things. It's like going into the store and you buy the most expensive, coolest looking thing you have, and then you realize, well, you know, I can't really do anything with this. You know, or I use an example of building a car, for example, an automobile is made up of, you know, a lot of little parts, and each of them some more important than others, but they each have a necessary role. And what the Japanese do is they buy like a windshield, some wipers, a steering wheel, three tires, and maybe a seat, and they think they have a car. But at the back of their minds, they know, well, the Americans really, they have a real car and they can take me to the mall if I need to go. But that's been the Japanese approach to defense, is this haphazard sort of approach, which has not been well thought out or well constructed. And whenever anybody tries to tell them this or suggest they do more, they kind of get angry, you know, at you or at the Americans. And they they've ended up with a defense which is really not very good for what they need to defend themselves. And it's got to the point that it is so, you know, it's so serious that this really, it just can't continue to have any
but
chance.
In their defense, they're like light years ahead of Germany, right? I mean, which is completely disarm yourself and not even service the the notion that you may have a viable military. So I mean, the at least Japan in its worst isn't Germany.
Yes, to their credit, they're that that's true. But that just points out, I think, how bad the Germans or how far the Germans have dismantled their defense. But the Japanese, when you stop and think about it, and especially when you weigh it up against what the Chinese have managed to put together defense-wise in the last 20, 30 years, the Japanese really are in trouble, to my way of thinking. And that's what I was writing about. So the Aegis ashore, you know, just watching them in action when they... you know, you really just kind of left sort of, you know, you say that you I'm smirking, but you, but if I wasn't an adult, I'd probably be crying. And, you know, one, I forgot actually the best of the excuses was you'd mentioned it is the fear that the alleged fear as a reason for canceling it, that something, one of the booster missiles might fall off and hit somebody on the ground. And to hear the Japanese government say this with a straight face is what's so funny, because I gather that, you know, for forever, you could not, when Japanese aircraft landed at Haneda Airport, which is the domestic airport the airport closest to downtown Tokyo, that the planes always had to fly over Tokyo Bay, not over Tokyo itself. And you know how crowded Tokyo is.
Right.
But about, I think it was like 2 or 3 months ago, the Japanese government finally gave approval to let, you know, JAL, the Japan Airlines and ANA, the commercial jets, to let them overfly Tokyo at a very low level. And just from north to south, about 10 miles straight, you know, the run straight into Haneda. And they apparently come in very low, very noisy, but it's almost like old Hong Kong airport, but it's really low. And they come in like every 5 minutes or more, you know, in the afternoons, it seems. And couldn't something fall off that? The locals in Tokyo, they complained, but the Japanese government just ignored them. So this was, I refer to it as Abe's dog ate his homework excuse for canceling the Aegis system. But this is what they do.
What do you think the real reason is behind canceling the system?
Oh, I think domestic politics. Somebody wants to embarrass Abe, and he doesn't want to get embarrassed, so they've canceled the system. It's, I think it has nothing much to do with defense. If it's one of these stories that may come out some years from now in one of the weekly magazines in Japan, which cover scandals, just a guess. I say that's just a guess, but to make up for it all, the Japanese government is, they said that their Abe and his defense minister, they've sort of mentioned, well, we're going to get a strike. They call it a strike capability. And that is one of these things. It means something different to everybody,
right,
that says it. But if you ask most politicians and most officials, strike capability means you buy some cruise missiles and you put in the GPS coordinates and you hit launch. And a minute or two later, the North Korean missile sites blow up. And that's about the way they would think of it. And
yeah, we'd love that.
Yeah, yeah, it works. You know, it's really easy. You know, go to Walmart and buy three of them.
Thank you.
But they say that. And it's really designed just to keep people thinking that they're serious about defense.
Or they're not.
But that is sort of typical of just how the thinking that goes on here. And they've also announced that they're going to hold some meetings later this summer to rethink their national defense strategy. And if I pointed out that if it takes you more than 10 minutes for the Japanese government to know what they need to defend themselves, you know, God help them. you know, you need a properly funded, manned and equipped and well-trained, balanced defense force that's really close to the Americans. That's what they've always needed. But they've instead, it's strike capability, buy shiny objects, et cetera, et cetera. And you could maybe in the piece you can see maybe 30 years of frustration after 30 years sort of oozing up on my part. But that's sort of the latest tempest in a teapot involving Japan's defense.
I want to ask you about ASEAN leaders here recently have pushed back. They cite a 1982 UN convention on the law of sea. And I'll read a quote from one of the articles. Even as our region struggled to contain COVID-19, alarming incidents in the South China Sea occurred. We call on the parties to refrain from escalating tension and abide by responsibilities under international law, Duterte said in his speech. ASEAN must be the guardian of our own region, not the projection of powers by bigger nation, said Joko Widodo at the summit. So you have all kinds of leaders making a very bold statement. And then this morning or within the last 24 hours, stories that the Chinese have made a major petroleum discovery in the South China Sea, which would be a big deal because, 80% of the petroleum that powers China has to go through the Malaccan Straits. And then from a headline from the from Asia Times, which you used to or still do write for, I'm not sure. ASEAN finally, that's the Association of the Southeast Asian Nations, just so you don't, in case you don't know, ASEAN, finally pushes back on China's sea claims. Subheadline, regional grouping fires salvo at China with new insistence South China Sea disputes must be settled as U.S. demand, as U.S. demands under the law of the sea, or the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. So telling China that they have to behave by the rules, which I assume China will simply ignore. Your thoughts on all of this? Why, very publicly, which is somewhat atypical for the Philippines to do that? What's going on?
You know, I think the Chinese have just pushed so much that, you know, even ASEAN, you know, writ large has, you know, at least said, you know, could you please play nice? You know, it sounds better than it is, I think, in that they've said, well, let's follow the rules that everyone's agreed to and that you agreed to as well. Couldn't we do that? But you know, I think it is a reflection of just how sort of irritated and worried that most ASEAN nations are about Chinese behavior in not just the South China Sea, but in general, just how pushy and aggressive and threatening it's become. Not that they didn't already know it, but it's, you know, certainly, you know, it seemed to have stepped up a notch, if that's possible, and I think it is possible.
So this is a reaction to increased Chinese aggression in the region.
I think it is that okay. They've never liked it. You know, but at the same time, that nobody has been willing to sort of speak out individually for sure. But even as a group, it's always been very hard for ASEAN to stand up for itself. Their militaries aren't really all that strong, and it's certainly not any sort of equivalent of NATO in its good days or even its bad days. Right. But as a political grouping, though, there is something to it. But they say they've not been able to really speak up, you know, for fear of China ultimately, and also they've had a problem in that Cambodia and Laos have been firmly under Chinese sort of sway, and so that to come up with a collective position on something has always been very, very difficult, in fact generally impossible owing to Chinese pressure. So to have the all 10 nations unanimously make a statement like this, you know, it's easy to just dismiss it. But at the same time, it's kind of interesting to see them do it, particularly to think of why Cambodia and Laos went along with it. And it does, you know, it calls for, and the significance of it is not insignificant in that it's calling for China to obey international law as everyone has agreed to. And when they resolve any disputes in the South China Sea area. And so you're effectively telling the Chinese, we're going to use these rules that you approved and that actually we already know that according to these laws that what you are doing, what you have done is against the law. And so it is something of a slap in the, a little bit of a slap in the China's face. It's not a huge slap, but it is something. There's some precedent on ASEAN's side, and to include the Philippines in particular. And sort of, I kind of live and breathe it, so I sort of remember it well. But what happened is, around 2014, the Philippines took China to court, to one of the international courts in The Hague, and they basically sued China, saying that China's claims to own all of the South China Sea and China's seizure of Philippine islands was illegal. And after a couple of years of thinking about it, the court came back with its ruling, and it gave the Philippines about a 98% victory. And it said that you're right, that what the Chinese have done in claiming that they own all of the South China Sea because some Chinese guy saw it 5,000 years ago, and then having come and parked themselves in your Philippine territory and sort of started stripping the seabed of nice giant clams and everything else, that this is illegal. So the Philippines had this ruling, and they were hoping, and they thought, well, this is great. You know, China's going to have to follow it. Well, China ignored it. They referred to the ruling as a piece of scrap paper, a piece of waste paper, and said, well, we're not going to follow it. But it was so, it had been publicized, it was so obvious what had happened, that it was really embarrassing for the Chinese, because it was on front page news everywhere. And it does make you look like a scofflaw. So the Filipinos were hoping that the Americans would actually come and put in a good word for them. The Americans didn't. I'm not making this up.
I hate when that happens.
Kind of. And in fact, what happened is the Americans, I think they made a statement or two saying, well, we see the court has ruled. This is nice. And then shortly after that, I think it was the CNO, the U.S. Navy CNO, and I think it was Susan Rice, Mr. Obama's national security, whatever she was.
Yeah, she was NSA.
Okay, they went to Beijing to have discussions with the Chinese. And while they were there, apparently, they did not mention the court's ruling. Didn't even bring it up. And I think that I have heard is the idea was, well, the Chinese will appreciate us not rubbing their nose in this, and then they will give us, they'll be nice. They'll help us out on all these other things. You know, we'll show them that, you know, we don't mean ill will. We're not going to embarrass them, and we'll get something from it. Well, we got nothing other than, like, further confirming to the Chinese that no matter what they do, America will do nothing. And what do you think the Filipinos thought of all this? Not much. So that's just some history. But the point that now the Philippines, they've had this ruling, and a lot of them, including in the ruling class, the foreign policy class, don't appreciate what has happened. You know, that China's taken their territories, bullying them. And even Duterte, for whatever, is either can see which way the wind is blowing in the Philippines, or maybe he genuinely is irked a little bit. You know, he's made these statements, and the head of Indonesia, May, made a similar comment about this court case, saying, you know, there was this court case. China's claim to South China Sea has no legal basis, which was something. And I think Malaysia has also shown some signs of raising the issue. So it's interesting to see how, once again, ASEAN has sort of moved a little bit to sort of defend their interests. But there is a limit to how far they will go. But nonetheless, they're not rolling over. And
well, that's the story, right? Because normally this isn't Australia has got sideways with China because they had the unmitigated gall to ask for an independent review of China's actions as China delivered the coronavirus to the rest of the planet without warning or the truth, that Australia would be so bold to ask for an independent review of this thing and not something done by papered over by the World Health Organization. So for the Philippines in particular, Vietnam not so much, but for these nations to be so visible in their criticism of China is, to me, that's the story. That's the story. And I guess a question is that the Chinese have announced that they've made a major petroleum discovery in the eastern part of the South China Sea. I believe it's not too far off the coast of where Hong Kong is. So it would probably be in the Chinese economic exclusion zone and not in anybody else's. However, most of that which is in the South China Sea has multiple claims of nation's economic exclusion zone, which means, you know, if you find it, I can go in there and drill too. And if I drill, if I drill in my sovereign economic exclusion zone, we're both going to tap that mine. Is this what this is dancing towards? Are ultimately the rich natural resource underneath there?
I'd like to see the details of the oil find that the Chinese announced. I sort of believe it when I see it, but that said, there is resources in the South China Sea that the countries that have a claim to it, they all want to tap into it. And what China has done is said the entire South China Sea is ours, and it's ours. And if you're going to try and take stuff from our place, you know, be prepared to have us come and stop you. So this has made it very hard for the Vietnamese to drill for oil in their territory, and some foreign companies that have been with them have pulled out. They've been harassed when they've been out drilling, and etc. So I think this is part of the pushback, is to say, you know, we're at least not going to, you know, give it to you. But there is a sort of a natural resources angle. Some would say if there are any fish, there's a little bit of a fish angle, but I'm not sure how many fish are actually left in the South China Sea. There are some, but the Chinese can eventually they'll catch them all. but it's strategic. The territory is as strategic terrain as you will get. You know, right on the sea lanes, going up into Northeast Asia and onward to America. And if you can control those, choke them off. Well, one, you've sort of put Japan out of business. But everyone else in the country, in the region, is going to feel it very quickly. And there's, to me, the more interesting talk rather than the oil thing, which is interesting because you never know where you're going to find stuff, is the rumors that China is about to declare an ADIZ, an Air Defense Identification Zone, over the South China Sea. And this has just been reported. It's got some press coverage. It's been around for a while, but the press coverage suggests that China's giving it some serious thought. And that means that one step at a time, they declare this ADIZ, the zone. And you just first declare it. And then step by step, you start to require permission for people to go through your defense zone. And then if that's the air, we'll do the same thing with the water. So you can close off shipping or control it and use it to pressure people.
And, you know, and critics of that, Grant, will say, well, I mean, how can they implement that? And the answer is through economic blackmail, right? And so what they say is, hey, look, your commercial airliners are going to need to, to check in and play the game. And that's how we want you to do this. And if you don't, then there's going to be trouble. And, you know, all that beef that we import, we're going to stop doing that. Oh, is that all you need is for us to check in? That's not an issue. And so, you know, you wonder how the world gets turned upside down. This is how the Chinese do it. It's like a boa constrictor slowly but surely squeezing its prey to death.
Well, that's a good way to put it. And you say it's one step at a time. And that, I think, is what has gotten the bulk of ASEAN at least willing to do something. You know, to say something, and it's almost in some ways you could interpret as a plea to the civilized world to get involved here and sort of stand up for international law. And this is not arcane international law. This is pretty obvious stuff that, you know, it's how countries have been behaving for a long time. Despite the law, you do have China building the islands, expanding the islands, they're expanding their military presence. They're getting the ability to really assert their dominance, their control over the region. They're expanding, they're increasing it. It's getting more powerful, more feasible. But the ASEAN has, at least said something. And one sort of interesting aspect that says a lot about what China's got in mind is the ASEAN countries and China have been talking about something called a code of conduct for the South China Sea. And the idea is that they will all agree that territorial disputes will be settled peacefully and legally by law. Nobody will take the South China Sea. So all these things that China is doing, they've been working on a code of conduct to get all parties to agree that they won't act like China, and for China to agree it won't act like China. They have been talking about this since 2002, a little longer actually. It's been about 20 years, and they're still working on the code of conduct agreement. And China's glad to have it, just sort of delay and delay and delay while it's cranking out, Navy and Coast Guard ships, faster than you can imagine, getting itself established. A couple of years ago, they'd like to get it if they could. The Chinese wanted to have put into the draft code an agreement that none of the parties to the code, none of the ASEAN states, could let outside nations would do joint military training with an outside nation unless China approved. So think about that. So China wanted in the agreement that the Americans and the Japanese too, but particularly the Americans, would not be allowed to train with any of these ASEAN countries unless China approved it. And that gives you a sense of just how they want the whole thing and want dominance. So that the ASEAN, most of them have been a little uncertain, unsettled by this. But doing something about it, that's sort of a bigger challenge. And they secretly, my sense has always been that they sorely want the Americans to stay in Asia, because they know that without the Americans there, then China isn't even going to bother trying to negotiate a code of conduct.
Right. Let me switch gears with you. Stories written that they come from Japan, saying that Japan believes that the more erratic behavior than normal that coming out of North Korea may be a cover for, in fact, the death of Kim Jong-un. Did you see that story?
I did see it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
I wish it was true. I really do, because it's kind of an interesting story, but good riddance to this guy. But I have my doubts. Here's why. Because Japan has got, there's about a million or so what are called, they're like Japanese Koreans. you know, they're long-term residents of Japan, and they're, you know, brought over years, were, got to Japan years ago, some voluntary, some not. But they've got a lot of people in Japan who have still have close family ties with North Korea. Japanese underworld, in fact, has extremely close ties with North Korea and, you know, drug dealing and all sorts of stuff. Some of them even go there for vacation or to get to relax, it is said. But the underworld has pretty good ties with North Korea. And yet, and also North Korea is just across the water. And yet you, what you hear is that, and also there, within Japan, there is a chunk of the Japanese Korean community that is actually very pro-North Korean. So you actually have, there's a couple guys who are actually considered overseas members of the North Korean parliament who are in Japan. They're like business guys and live up in northern part of Tokyo, but that's another story. But the point is, Japan has all these connections to North Korea. Yet over the years, whenever you talk to, say, a Japanese official about, like, what do you know about North Korea? They will claim that they haven't the slightest idea. But what do you Americans know? I could never tell if the Japanese were playing stupid when it came to North Korea, or they just didn't know. And I don't know, but I have a feeling that they, you know, that they, I don't think they know if if the guy's alive or not. You know, they, you know, for all the access they should have, everything they should know, I've never been all that impressed with what it seems as though the Japanese government
does
and officialdom knows about North Korea. So, because you would think they know something, you know, the wisdom of the Orient. I don't think he does. And when I listened to what, I think it was Kono, with I think it was defense minister, the guy who said it. Yeah. When you actually read what he said, it didn't sound like he really knew or had any sort of inside stuff, sort of like George Tenet talking about, or Colin Powell talking about WMD in Iraq.
You know the best part of that story about Powell talking about WMD. You know who, if you recall his testimony, do you know who was sitting in the shot over his shoulder?
George Tenet. Yeah.
And the reason why Tenet was sitting there was Powell wanted everybody to know where this shit was coming from. I can't tell you how I know this, but
I didn't know. I'm glad to hear that.
Right.
And I'm not surprised.
That Powell said, you know, the president, Powell was not for the course of action. President Bush Jr. said, you're my Secretary of State, and I need you to do this. And Powell, I think much to his everlasting regret, did it. But he insisted that George Tenet sit in the picture behind him so that, for the record, everybody would know where this came from.
I'll be darned. I didn't know that, but you had the feeling that Powell could barely resist the urge to turn around and say, George, don't you have any agents in Iraq? This seems like somebody's made it up.
Well, and, you know what? But you know what they did?
I had that feeling when I was listening to Kono, to the Japanese fellow, talking about it, that it seemed a little too much based on, well, they're acting nuttier than usual.
So,
therefore, it must be, you know, a different nut. It seemed that way. I didn't get the impression that, you know, he heard the telltale words or that said, look, we really know something's going on here. And you know, his former sushi chef, who used to be a Japanese guy, is a Japanese guy. He told us, you know, looked at him and he's not as plump as he remembered him or something.
Right.
It just didn't seem that way to me. So,
All right. Let me ask you. Let me switch gears again. We talked about the India, China, right? Steel bar, throw people off the cliffs, right? Fight from a couple weeks ago, and now the latest is India's banning Chinese applications. India's I'll read a little paragraph. A day after India banned 59 Chinese-owned mobile applications, raising privacy concerns about user data, right? So applications, the most famous of which I believe is TikTok, that is, you know, is this dance app, but the Chinese harvest all kinds of data from it. Anyway, Beijing's mission in India issued a strong statement accusing India of indulging in, quote, discriminatory practice. India's measure selectively and discriminately aims at certain Chinese apps on ambiguous and far-fetched grounds, runs against fair and transparent procedure requirements, abuses national security exceptions, and suspects of violations of WTHO rules, said China. Which is laughable that the Chinese would say that. But India and China, is this just the start of that conflict becoming a big deal? Or do you believe that this will soon pass too?
You know, you always wonder, you know, with these, when something, the incidents happen, that, you know how sometimes when you wait a couple weeks or even a couple months, you know, things look a lot different.
Right.
You know, there's a natural human desire from civilized people to just kind of let conflict blow over and get on with life. But so the passage of time will tell us. But I think that something has changed here. It's maybe not like a 180, but it's sort of certainly given some impetus to a sort of more of a shift from India's part towards the U.S., towards Japan, towards Australia, towards, let's say, the free countries with whom India has things in common. And, you know, but the shift was already going. And I think the Chinese have pushed this, have helped push this along. The troubles with China on the border are longstanding. This was just something beyond the pale. And I think I think the effect is going to be more longer. With this part, and there's a very well-respected Indian commentator called Brahma Chalani, and he's always, if you see his name on something, you have to read it.
Chalani, that sounds Irish.
Well, they went out of the pub to go to the outhouse, and they forgot to stop, I suppose, and ended up in India. But it's Chellany. But he's very good. And but he referred to Modi, the head of India, he referred to him as his policies until recently as appeasing China. And he laid it out that when Modi took over in 2014, that he was, you know, he held, you know, a summit with Xi Jinping and, you know, welcomed Indian investment into India, or Chinese investment into India. But he let that flood of money come in, buying up all sorts of stuff and getting their, you know, Indian products to drive it, Chinese products to kind of take, you know, to get really a foothold into India. But this may be the thing that has sort of woken up Modi. The head of India, and time will tell, but I think something's different now. And the talk of India putting on or boycotting Chinese goods, and the as you'd mentioned, these apps being prohibited, and also there's been delays on imports from China, Indian ports, and that's no accident. But the test is whether or not this gives some breathing room to Indian companies to sort of take over, to sprout, you know, in the face of this really unnatural Chinese economic competition. Because when I say unnatural, it's, you know, they'll always undercut you until they've driven you out of business, and then they've got the market, and then prices go up. But the time will tell. You know, how serious India is, and if the Indian industry will use the breathing space to sort of do a lot less business with China, and supply chains is something you hear a lot today, and stop, say, being so dependent on China. It kind of sounds like America, if you think about it. you know, are our businesses going to take advantage of the opportunity to get sort of off the addiction to China? And, you know, we'll see. But, you know, but on the defense front, you are seeing, I think it's a shift, you know, really towards improving India's defense to the extent it can, but also to do more things more often and qualitatively different with their friends in the region and the world. You know, when you have, for example, talk of the Australians and the Indians cooperating for maritime surveillance, so sharing some of their islands down in the southern part of the Indian Ocean. When you hear that being talked about seriously, well, that tells you something. You have the Japanese Navy's been out in the Indian Ocean regularly, and, you know, they, I think you might almost consider their dealings with the Indian Navy now kind of routine. So there is, has shifted things a bit, but as noted, the Chinese have had the pressure on the Indian border for so long now that they, you know, there was already a momentum against China in parts of India. You know, keep in mind it's a big place and there's a lot of different opinions about what should be done with China, what should be done with America, and there's even a bunch of guys that still think Russia's the best place on earth. So there's a range of thought in India, but this is something to pay attention to. And if you, I guess once you get old enough, you kind of have some context. And if you remember how India was like 30, 40 years ago, you know, with this love fest with the old Soviet Union, that it is a striking change to see how things have developed in the last 10, 15 years.
There's a New York Times ran a piece talking about the United States and China are heading for a divorce. And there's two things to blame. The wonderful thing about the internet is, you know, the New York Times wants you to pay for it, but other websites will publish it and you can read it for free there. This happens in firstpost.com. But anyway, there's two reasons for it. One is China's overreach. And the second one is the American underreach or underperformance in the region. And, you know, I've talked about this relative to, I think, the glaring failure of I say this as a conservative who likes, well, Donald Trump is not one of my favorite politicians. I will say he's done, I think, great things for the American economy. I think he's done the necessary things relative to China. But the headline is America and China are heading for a divorce. And so do you think that is simply American recognition? And it's been kind of a theme for this discussion, right, that, you know, the recognition on the part of the Philippines, you know, which is the thing that breaks squelch. Vietnam constantly will yell and raise the issue of China. As you just said, India and Australia, right, partnering with intelligence assets in the region. Do you think this is simply the basic recognition by an American administration that we will no longer, you know, look the other way for the economic benefits of being able to buy soccer balls for $5.99 at Walmart? And that at some point, we had to come off the notion that, you know, more economic integration with the free world would somehow change China, when we've seen evidence to the contrary now for a couple decades. So is this really a divorce and the beginning of the confrontation of China's predatory economic policies? Or do you see this as something that may reverse itself should, you know, Joe Biden be elected president?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Yeah, that's the question. And maybe depends on what time of day you ask me. But I would like to think that given what's happened over the last few years in our dealings with China and also in Chinese behavior, that I'd like to think that this has woken a few people up in particularly America's political class, you know, the foreign policy class, these people who really decide on what our policy is going to be. And, you know, I'd like to think it has woken them up. The business class, I think there are, you know, certainly it's not as, you know, they were just simply giving away the game just a few years ago. But now I think there is a recognition that the Chinese market is not what they thought it was going to be. So they've woken up. I think there's been some awakening in both of those quarters, but also I think with the public writ large, that when people think of China, they think of the virus, not Panda Express and the $8.99 orange chicken. That it, you know, I think the public thought of China has shifted a bit as well. I'd like to think this is a sea change that, you know, and it's going to just keep diverging. You know, it's not a complete, you know, it isn't like, you know, we'll airbrush them out of existence, but, you know, we're not the just nutty dependence that we had on them. I'd like to think that has ended. You know, some of the foreign policy class have written articles lately saying that, oh, China's surprised us. They're not going to, you know, they don't want to be like Canadians, as if anybody didn't know that. But some would say some of these people in line for positions in right. a Democratic administration have said things like this, that right. suggesting that, you know, they've at least for a while have come on to the we can't appease China anymore sort of school of thought, which is a good thing. So I thought if I had to give it a percentage chance, I'd say there's a 40% chance that, you know, we may actually continue with this distancing from China, which is better than like the 0% chance we had before Mr. Trump was elected. So 40% is not bad. I would note about this article in the New York Times that there was actually one written, and I forget where it appeared, Washington Examiner or Wall Street Journal, I forget which, but maybe written by a fellow named Moreland. This was at the start of all of this coronavirus, and it's a fascinating story, but it's he beat the New York Times to the story by 3 months. His story's actually better.
Let me tell you that to me the most interesting quote in this story, and that is this: Chinese officials see a unified front on trade and human rights by the U.S. and its allies as, quote, Washington's greatest asset for checking China's widening influence, and Trump's behavior ensures that will never come about. But while China may think it has nothing to fear and much to gain from a Trump victory over Joe Biden, the real U.S.-China story should be cause for alarm for Beijing, and that is that both sides are migrating to the same position, right? And that if Biden is elected, I think this could be more dangerous for China because he will work with allies to target China, whereas Trump is destroying U.S. alliances. And to me, the curious part of, you know, the president's behavior, and you and I have talked about this, is that, okay, so you don't like the Pan-Pacific Partnership, okay? Now, why have we not seen in 4 years bilateral agreements one after the other, you know, that supplant that? That are better deals for the Americans, for the United States, and better deals for, you know, whatever country, fill in the blank. Why haven't we seen that? And so to me, while, you know, the president does certain things that, you know, are confrontational relative to China, you know, it's like he has not given life to the most dangerous course of action for the Chinese. Does that make sense? And answer that, and I will let you go to sleep.
Yeah, well, there's things I, you know, wish the administration had got hit the ground running. I wish it had got more of its people in place and done more when it comes to particularly China policy. It's amazing it's done as much as it has, and it's, you know, really owing to, I think, the work of probably just a small group of people who really have, you know, have just done fabulous work to try and turn things around. But the administration didn't get get a good start, and I think that's its own fault. And there's things it could have done. But that said, as we've said before, that it really has. It's been better than all of the previous 40 years put together. Is this going to, continue? I don't know. I'd like to think it does, but. Right. My goodness, there's particularly if you hang around the foreign policy class for a while, that there's always a willingness to split the difference with an opponent, no matter how awful the opponent is, and thinking, well, we've got to, we'll cooperate where we can, and challenge them where we must, or something like that. And it sounds this really statesman-like thing, but it's really kind of stupid. If the other side has no interest in anything but destroying you, one can imagine when the Mongols were coming into Eastern Europe in the 13th century, there's probably some Hungarian guy with a master's degree from Georgetown who said, well, with these Mongols, let's see what we can do with them. But if we have to take them on, well, we will. But the Mongols are thinking, great, we're going to kill all of you. But the point is, sometimes you have to. There is no room for negotiation or compromise. You have got to defend your interests and be prepared to fight for them. And so there's this willingness in our sort of elite class to say split the difference and try and work out a deal, even with somebody who doesn't want it. Deal. And I would. There's one note that you'd mentioned it that the because you hear it all the time. With the people afflicted with Trump derangement syndrome, it's that Mr. Trump has destroyed alliances. And I hear this all the time, and I don't see the evidence for it. I know that there's plenty of people who hate Donald Trump, and they, sort of irrationally, but in terms of destroying alliances, I don't see it. And one could also say, compared to what? Now, you will recall that I was talking about the court decision on the Philippines' behalf that gave them everything they needed to push back China. And I just described that an administration basically sold out a friend of ours who was desperate for us to protect them. That was the Obama administration. The Japanese during the Obama administration were as worried as you could possibly be that the Americans were giving China too much. When we talk about destroying alliances, and not you, but I hear it all the time with the people in these debates but I just don't see the evidence of it. Yes, Mr. Trump's a guy from Queens, so he's kind of direct in asking somebody who's getting a free ride to, chip in for, could you chip in a bit for dinner or some gas money? But just that is considered beyond the pale.
Right. So the status quo is everything. The alliances are okay, and our partners can continue to, grope around in the dark for some defensive approach. As long as the United States continues to pay and doesn't rock the boat. And so to me, what the president has done, I think that it needed to be done was say, okay, how is this in America's interest? Show me. And if you're not pulling your fair share of the weight, you need to do that. And we'll, of course, do ours, but don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining. And Germany is the worst. Germany has a flow of urine that has gone down our backs forever. And now it's like we're going to move 9,500 troops out of Germany, and that's going to destabilize Europe. The true destabilizing force on the European continent is Germany's lack of a military. That enables Russia. Germany's behavior of getting into the energy business with Russia, building a pipeline with Russia. And so, to me, I agree with you, the whole Trump derangement system. But I just find it curious. Because again, you have stated this, and I've listened, and now I say it like it's my idea. But that if there is no other course of action other than the free nations of the world, who represent four times the GDP of China, to band together, and hang together, or China will surely hang you separately economically. And there is no other course of action, yet it seems like there's some reluctance to do that. And the United States doesn't seem like it wants to be in the business in the Pacific region of doing that. And I don't rightly understand that. So while I will give, you know, the president and his administration high marks for all that they've done relative to, you know, stopping the playing of the emperor's new clothes, I wonder why the most deadly course of action is not being developed in a more formidable fashion.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Because throughout, you know, this administration, you know, there's all, like, I think for both all of us, there's been, you know, things that you say, oh boy, I wish they'd done this, or why don't they do that?
Right.
Like, couldn't they just do that? And often little things that would have made a difference. It's, you know, maybe that's the way things go, but you could see missed opportunities, and I think it's partly a function that there just weren't enough people in this administration to actually get stuff done, and that I think is maybe one of the strategic faults of this administration. If there's a second one, I hope they address it. There's, you know, I think I've even written about a few things that, you know, I wish they'd have done.
Right.
And time matters. You don't have forever to
get
things done. You've got to move fast on this.
Right.
So we'll see.
All right. What are you writing next? And first of all, tell everybody the title of your latest piece about Japan and the land-based Asia system. Where do they find that?
Oh, it's in Asia Times. I forget what the title is. It's something. I don't write the titles, but it's something snide, I'm sure. It says it says something like Aegis Ashore or Japan's Defense. Something doesn't add up.
Yeah, Abe's Aegis Ashore cancellation doesn't add up.
No, it doesn't. But I don't know what's next. I have to fix my computer first.
What's wrong with it?
I don't know. I'm sure it's my fault.
Of course,
it always is. Yeah. But I think it's not big enough for
playing Candy Crush too much.
I'm a gamer. Yeah, so I think it's my game apps, which is no. It's an old computer, so that's what's got me preoccupied. That's why I sound incoherent tonight. So. Yeah, but I'm trying to. I don't know what's next. Something about the Pacific Islands.
Oh,
in the world.
And the Chinese purchase thereof.
They've got their claws in it.
Yeah. Got it. All right, Grant. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Always appreciate you staying up late and making us smart. So have a nice 4th of July, and we'll talk to you in a bit.
Okay. Thanks very much. Always enjoy it.
There you have it, Grant Newsham here. Talking about the Western Pacific on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio. You know, what's interesting is that, you even have Democrats that are talking, and again, from Bush to Obama, you know, there's 16 years of, you know, somehow or other believing that China would behave contrary to every policy it enacts, every conflict it approaches, be it economic or cultural or whatever. In our administrations, they have access to all kinds of information. You know, Chinese influence in the university system, right? Chinese espionage in the business world, right? All of this they have access to. And we've been playing charades with the Chinese. But, I mean, even if you listen to Joe Biden, I mean, he talks that, our relationship with China has to evolve, if you will. And but again, I do. It almost like, you know, the president gets accused of this relative to Vladimir Putin. Like, what does Putin have on him that he doesn't come out, you know, and really tattoo his ass? And, to me, I find that curiously similar relative to the most deadly course of action relative to China, which is a concerted approach by the United States, South Korea, Japan, Australia, Vietnam, and whoever else wants to fucking join, to say, look, we will all levy, you know, these measures against you if you don't simply play by the rules. If you don't simply play by the rules. Now, I will say this. I was curious as to where that petroleum discovery was by the Chinese People's Petroleum Company, right? And let me tell you what will precipitate the conflict. And there might be some boats that get sunk by Chinese fishing vessels that are really Chinese Navy vessels that are doing their work. But anyway, it will be over a larger find. It will have multiple claimants to it in terms of nations. Because the resource that is discovered will be so substantial, you'll see nations like Vietnam or the Philippines or Malaysia or Indonesia, they won't be able to turn their backs on it. They won't be able to say, whatever, let the Chinese have it. It'll be too significant. And that will force a confrontation. So, Grant, always fun to have on the program. But again, the world plays Emperor's New Clothes because China will blackmail you. To me, it's similar to what totalitarian regimes think of free nations. We can use their system against them. Well, it's difficult for them to do the same thing against us. So we are truly in the more powerful position relative to democracies. And with the internet, you know, every one of their internal conflicts, we can pour gasoline on. And we can continue to stabilize Western democracies that stabilizes us. Because they are a threat to us, but only when they act in concert, right? You know, the United States, because it's the financial capital of the world and its economy is so big, you know, we need, this is a Chinese perspective, we need the United States as much as, maybe more than the United States needs us. And so we should be careful with them. But for everybody else, we don't need anybody else. We can supplant whatever we turn off with somebody else. So they'll play by our games because the biggest thing they want from us is to sell into China, which raises their economy and their labor force and their standard of living. So that's the name of that tune. So that's how China does it. So interesting stuff here on a Tuesday. Grant's always interesting, and I always enjoy the conversation with him. So that'll do it. 25 long minutes longer than I'm supposed to be, but since I run the show, that's my decision. All right. If you're just tuning in, in hour one, we talk about, is the world actually going crazy? I think so. Yeah, no kidding. I do. Talk a little bit about the, breaking news late last night, early this morning, about Pentagon is reporting that there's no corroborating evidence relative to the Russian bounty thing. Now, that won't have anything to do with the discussion. The fact that the Pentagon says, okay, look, yes, I mean, you know, some of our special operations guys reported that people they interrogated said this. Okay. But as Will Cosentini and I were talking yesterday, once you ask about three questions, I mean, it's a stupid thing. And the reason it's stupid, the bounty thing is stupid, is for a couple of $100,000, and word of this will get out because the Afghans will talk when captured. They always do. And they'll spill their guts. And so word of that will get out, and it will cost us billions. billions of dollars in American economic sanctions. So to me, as you begin to footnote this and run this thing really to ground, you know, where does it come from and whatnot? So, but that won't have any impact on the political narrative of it. So, right, everybody's heard, don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. Well, that's okay when you're telling a bullshit story in a bar and everybody's laughing. I don't think it's okay when we talk about the democracy. But, as we all know, the truth doesn't matter in the American media anymore. White hot and be first so you can get the most clicks, so you can be the number one leader in whatever you are. But it's not the truth, and that's kind of a problem. So, anyway, on a Tuesday, we'll talk about that. So if you're just tuning in, don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio. And do not be afraid to go change somebody's life today. I intend to do that here momentarily. That's right. So have a great day. On a Tuesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.